That's a fascinating question, Shaz. I think it's as soon as I say one way, someone turns around immediately and does it the other way and does it better. When I start writing something, whether it's a chapter or whether it's a...
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Living a Life Through Books, the podcast about everything bookish. I'm your host, Dr. Shaz Ahmed, and today is Author Conversations. I have a very special guest, John Maxwell, but before I bring him up, I have a quick request. Please take a look at the show notes for ways to support me. There's also the link for WriteScene, the latest and greatest platform for creative connections, so please don't forget the show notes. Now, let's get to Author Conversations. J.P. Maxwell has run a newspaper kiosk, worked for a Californian software company, and studied Russian language at the University of London. Now he writes books, makes films, and lectures in creative writing and digital writing at Liverpool John Moores University. He has a passion for the more scandalous aspects of history that reveal truths about modern life. July 1st, 2023, saw the launch of his debut novel, Water Street, which details Liverpool's pivotal moment in 1863 during the American Civil War, and how a secret battle was won and lost on its cobbled streets. I'll add the link to purchase Water Street in the show notes, and without further ado, let's meet John Maxwell with Author Conversations. John Maxwell, welcome to the podcast, Living Life Through Books. I am excited to have you here. And you're here because you're an author, and I just read your book, Water Street. I'm just kind of blown away. I'm intrigued because I'm reading this book. And you know what I did was I read the book and I'm going, wait, this guy is British. This is a British author. I'm like, what the heck is he writing about the American Civil War? And it was just totally like, it was eye-opening for me. So just tell me about the concept. Where did this concept come from? And that journey from the concept to where it is today?
Well, in a sense, it's interesting that hearing the word British, because it's strange, Liverpool, where I'm from, historically, was a very important place to Britain. It was a very prominent port. And it kind of sprang from nothing. It sprang from being a kind of a hamlet, really, or a small town within the space of 100 years. It just exploded and became very much at the start of the story, you know, capitalism and imperialism and all that sort of thing. So I've grown up with this. My background is Irish, a little bit of African in there going back. So there's a smattering of the story of the city in my very blood, and I'm very proud of that. And we're kind of one of the oldest melting pots in the world. You know, other parts of Britain, London historically always has been a melting pot, but other parts maybe less so. But Liverpool being a port, it would attract people from all over the world for lots of different reasons. You know, one of the things that underpins Water Street is the great hunger. Some people call it the potato famine, but I think it actually is a mistake to call it the famine. It was actually a disaster that was caused by the policy of governments. Hey, what's new, hey?
You know, governments have never messed anything up ever.
No. Yeah. They're such responsible, you know, non-corrupt people, aren't they? So.
Well, yeah, of course.
So I think it's kind of, I've grown up with particularly from my mother, but also from my dad, I suppose, that with this kind of sort of attitude, music comes into it as well. When I was a kid, my dad was a musician. So, you know, my mum was from a part of Liverpool called Dingle, Liverpool 8, which to anyone who's not from the city knows that as being the sort of center of everything, really. It's just, you know, it had a really bleak time in the 1980s and there were riots there. And, you know, so a lot of this maps to stuff that's happened in American history. And in a sense, mm-hmm. the word British is very interesting because historically, I would argue, and this is going to sound bizarre, but Liverpool is an American and an Irish city and an African city, indeed.
Wow. So For me, everything is, it's so funny. Like whenever I've talked, I've been like, oh, you're from London, right? Because in a clueless American way, the entire Great Britain is all London. And it's like, and so
Sure,
now you're like, oh, Liverpool. I'm like, oh, wait. So now I'm kind of trying to be like, oh, Britain. Let's just call it Britain. It's good.
It's all, it's, I mean, it, you know, it's all kind of on identity in a way, I suppose. But I think what kind of underpinned it was, you know, amongst all these kind of greater sort of cultural sort of references and family references, was a few years ago, I wrote a film treatment. Because I kind of in a past life, in a sense, I made three feature films as a producer over
Wow.
here, and I was kind of, and I teach screenwriting, so I always come from a very sort of screenwriting sort of background, even though I'm actually interested in working with other screenwriters to adapt this, because it's a beast, you know, it's different. But yeah, it came from finding out that Liverpool had a very, very strong connection with obviously the United States, but the American Civil War itself. If you kind of if you pinpoint the 1860s, I found out that, you know, a Confederate Navy was pretty much built from scratch in the city. There was financing coming from the city, and all this is fact. It happened, you know, this is big time, you know, to the extent that and I've got documentary evidence of this, that the proposal from Abraham Lincoln's cabinet was that they were going to sail a flotilla up the Mersey and actually destroy these ships, which is mind-boggling. You know, so much for the special relationship. Boom. There it goes. Yeah.
See, I didn't know that. Like, so I'm reading your book, right? I'm reading your book. My husband is a mega historian and he loves the Civil War. Like, I mean, he could talk about the Civil War, every little detail about it. So I'm reading your book and I'm like, hey, did you know there was this British involvement in the American Civil War? And he's like, oh yeah. And he's throwing all these names, you know, and he's like, is this name mentioned? And is this name mentioned? Is this, I'm like, and I'm kind of like, how did I not know this? And it was really
Absolutely.
cool. I love it. And now
It's
that you're bringing up this Lincoln thing, that you have, there are documents about Lincoln wanting to destroy these ships that I have, you know, after this podcast, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to run to my husband and go, did you know this too? Like, it's fascinating.
Well, Lincoln sent one of his best men, as it were, at the time. Just to give you an idea, Liverpool was a very different place back then. Obviously, everywhere was very different back then, but it was a super city. It was a metropolis. It was on the scale of Paris. It was a big place. It had massive influence. And the U.S. consul, because we had a consulate here, this is how big it was considered, how important it was considered economically. The guy who he sent was a guy called Haynes Dudley, Thomas Haynes Dudley. He was in the book. He's one of the characters in the book. And Dudley had a choice between being the ambassador to Japan or becoming the consul to Liverpool, and he chose to be the consul to Liverpool. So that just gives you an idea of how important it was. And Dudley was instrumental, and I don't use that word lightly, in Lincoln being elected in the first place. So he's one of the president's men, as it were, was sent here, and he kind of formed a spy network of his own. So there were these two real people on the kind of opposing sides. So that there was a kind of Cold War situation going on here, where they were trying to subvert each other, and, you know, Napoleon the Third was involved. Yeah, my next book is, and I don't want to jump too far, but I can tell you a bit about that later. But my next book is the follow-up with some of the same characters, particularly Harriet, who's the central character, is in the next book, and that is about the Lincoln assassination, which also
It ends
has.
this way. Your book ends that final, the final ending is with Harriet at a grave. I'm not going to mention who or what, but Harriet's at a grave, and then there are these gentlemen, and I was like, ooh,
There's
oh, like
teasing.
I'm doing a whole bunch of O's at the end of your book. I was like, wow, okay.
I'm literally, th I was writing it today. I'm 35,000 words through, And it's sort of taken over my psyche. I'm in 1865 now, so 2 years afterwards.
Right,
And
right, right.
What happened? Well, there's two major connections. The campaign to, and originally was to kidnap Abraham Lincoln.
Oh.
That's what they were going to do. And it was financed out of Liverpool again. So wow. there was support in this kind of conspiracy to go and kidnap him. Eventually turned into this assassination plot. And which was obviously successful and
right.
changed history. But one of the conspirators to escape, of course, escaped to Canada initially, a guy called John Surratt. Mm. And where did he come? Where did he come after Canada? Right here.
Liverpool.
So, you know, it's all set up. It's all kind of boiling under. But Water Street, really, for me, is... it's heart and soul, you know. It's the Irish diaspora. It's this the slave industries. It's mm-hmm. all of that nefarious activity that was going on, mm-hmm. and Britain at the time being the kind of foremost world power in every way,
mm-hmm.
you know, feared, relied upon, culturally taken mm-hmm. over everywhere, you know, from you know its kind of power base in Asia, in India, the subcontinent, right across the world.
Right.
Right across the world. Africa, massive power.
Right.
And, you know, there was some, again, this is the fact that underpins the fiction. There was a sense in corridors of power here. And this is why some of the more outrageous stuff that goes on Water Street, uh-huh. I'm saying that this has got a basis in fact. Some of the corridors of power in Britain, in Westminster, in Whitehall, in government, firmly believed that the United States was getting too powerful.
Wow.
And actually, they were right.
Well, a little bit, you know.
Up to that point, yeah.
I think we've done well.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know about too powerful, but the you know, the thing is that they believed that, you know, the United States would come to a stage where they would challenge Britain and overtake Britain economically, mm-hmm. and they did. So there was a significant lure towards the Confederacy, and this is something that fascinates me. You know, I have to say, and I'll stand up straight away and say, you know, the Confederate whole idea behind the Confederacy was toxic and awful. And based upon subjugation, but you know there are so many nuances that are attached to it in terms of thinking and things that still survive to this day. You know,
that's what I was actually going to tell you, that you know, you would think, yeah, the Confederacy, you know, Civil War, 1860, you know, what was it, 60 to 65? You know, you think all of that, but then today, like. I talk, you know, like you talk to someone, they're like, oh, well, you know, Civil War really wasn't about slavery. You know, people are making that up. Mm. People are still talking about, yeah, like how slavery wasn't an issue and there were other reasons. And I don't even know what the conspiracy theory is right now. I don't know what the theory is for people to think. And I think just recently there was this whole thing about taking down the statues,
yeah,
of the Confederate leaders,
yeah, the good old boys, yeah,
yeah. So, but it's really cool. I love that, you know, you're writing about the American Civil War as a historic fiction. I have a couple of questions. Why historic fiction? Why not alternate history, or is that just overdone? And also, I'm really curious about Harriet and Woman's Pie, obviously married to the bad guy, the villain, whatever, and on top of it, and to add a cherry on the top, you make her pregnant. Like, so those are my two.
Yeah,
I know, it's like a million questions.
I like to give my characters challenges. you know, swims across the Mersey River and all that kind of thing. Yeah,
I know. She just jumped in the freaking river. And then you have the description. I have to tell you, I almost threw up. I was like, the way you describe it, the smells coming from it. And I'm like, oh, gross. You know, it's like this visceral reaction. I'm there. And then on top of it, she jumps in it.
Can I just say to any potential tourists who will be tuning into this podcast that they have actually cleaned the river up? So, you
Okay,
know,
good.
we're doing better these days. But
I'm glad to hear that.
I suppose, I mean, if we start with Harriet, because she is very important to me and I kind of almost kind of under her skin feel what she does. But Harriet has so many connections. She kind of, there's a bit of a backstory thing that goes on in the book where we find out how she meets Conti as a child, and they kind of grow up together.
Right.
And you know, she has it, she's from a mix of places. And again, believe it or not, this has got a basis in fact. You know,
Oh.
the Choctaw tribe of Louisiana, they were kind of forced out, like many of the Native Americans,
Sure.
to Oklahoma, again, like other Native American
Sure.
nations. They were very, very prominent at the time for adopting people into the tribes, you know, so many of the kind of tribal elders were had the kind of European ancestry as well as Native American ancestry. So there was a it was a big part of what happened back then. You know, ever since the Europeans arrived, that there was this mixing going on. So in a sense, they were their own melting pot, which is something I wanted to kind of use to kind of give this kind of background to Harriet. So it was kind of explain the logic of how and why she would be recruited, and she was this kind of feral sort of gunslinger
Right.
who kind of knew how to sort of survive in the bleakest of circumstances, and was able to kind of swim across a kind of nasty river in
I
that way.
yeah, I thought, what a scene, what a scene. I mean, I could see it. I mean, I can still see it. I'm like, what is going on here? I'm like, woman, but she didn't have a choice, but I mean, like.
Well, yeah, she was running from the peelers, but yeah. I think, you know, what makes Harriet, well, part of it's my mother, actually. I mean, my mother never swam across the Mersey while pregnant with me, or
Okay, I,
not,
you hope
as long
not.
as I know. I hope not. Well, maybe, well, she was a lot of things, but she had that kind of that strength. And you know, I'm not just bringing in female characters just to kind of, you know, be, you know, have diversity or anything like that. I know she's based upon, there was a very, very strong tradition of female spies, and it grew significantly during the American Civil War. So again, it has a foundation in fact. So Harriet is partly based upon a brilliant woman who's never really been well depicted in film, and I'd love to see this, called Harriet Tubman, who you guys will know about.
Yes, of course.
And Harriet was an incredible. You know, so partly this is going to sound a bit confusing, but Conte, who's the kind of other half of the pair, really, and she's amazing. Has got that kind of link to Harriet Tubman. Harriet herself is roughly based upon a Pinkerton detective called Kate Warne, who was very active during the American Civil War. Now, the Pinkertons were sort of the forerunners of the American Secret Service, I should say.
Okay, right.
So they were kind of Lincoln's bodyguard. They were really active during the Civil War in trying to undermine every Confederate action. So these were incredibly brave women. They were thrown in there, and the thinker behind it was that they could do, and they were right, that they could do things that men couldn't do. They could get into places that men couldn't do, and they were underestimated,
Right.
which is actually a great way to turn someone's
Right.
strength. It's almost like a kind of Bruce Lee trick, you know, you use your opponent's weight against you.
Right. Right.
And so that was the thinking behind it, you know, that someone like Bannister Dunwoodie, the arch villain of the piece,
Right. Ah, that's handsome.
would never
That's handsome.
suspect that his own wife, well, I'm doing something right if you can't stand him,
I
because
can't
that's
stand him.
what
I couldn't stand him. I just wanted to, oh. It's like
he's just
another visceral reaction. I just want to throw up every time he showed up on the screen. I just wanted to just strangle him. I'm like, just take a gun and shoot him. And I'm like, if you shoot him, there won't be a story until you gotta shoot him at the end. I'm like, oh, I can't stand him.
Oh, this is music to my ears, to be honest, Shannon, because this is exactly the kind of effect I want to achieve. There must be something going on, but there's actually something.
These scenes with Harriet and Dunwoody and with Bannister, and he had like bedroom stuff, and I'm like, can I just give me a bucket to throw up in? I'm like, these people, they're like having babies. I'm like, ew, gross. Just stay away from them. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh my gosh. I was just going crazy. But anyway.
But I mean, for me, and I have, this is going to sound a bit unnerving, but I've actually met people who've got aspects of Bannister in there. I wouldn't say they can the whole ticket, because you'd run very quickly away from someone like that. But
Right.
I've met certain, mainly men, to be honest, who have had that sort of toxic masculinity, to use a modern phrase.
Right.
But they've got that kind of awful ego, destructive ego. And yeah, I growing up, I've had, I've had a life. I've made mistakes myself. So
Sure.
I'm not gonna deny that there are aspects in, my past that I think that way as well. But I don't know.
Well,
I really
we all
try
try
and.
to be the best we can, and we hope we're not Bannisters because, oh my gosh, that was like horrid. But I have to tell you this about having a female spy and all that is the interesting thing is when I married my husband works for, I guess, Department of Defense. So
Oh, wow. Okay.
he worked at their like top secret building, all the stuff, right? So when we were dating and when we were going to get married and stuff like that, I come home one day and my neighbor says to me, "Hey, there were these men here asking about you. They were like knocking on doors and asking about you." I'm like, what? She's like, "I just
Wow.
want you to know." I'm like, "What the heck's going on?" Well, and I called my husband and he said, "You know, because of the nature of his position and all of that, that it was just, oh, he's just, that's just standard protocol. They just want to make sure you're not a spy and that you're not marrying me for information." I'm like, yeah, I look like a spy. Like, seriously, I look like Harriet here. No.
Oh, well,
But
that's
no,
all
that's,
right then.
yeah.
Oh,
But you know, I mean, I can see that today, having a woman spy, and I can totally see that. But yours isn't like 1863, so that was really, really, really cool. So,
well, thank you. I mean, speaking of other halves, partners, wives and husbands, my wife, yeah, she laughs at me because, I teach in a university here, creative writing and digital writing. That's my sort of like, that's my dingling make money job, put food on the table job,
cool.
and she works in health and social care, so she sees all kinds of things, in the health systems and stuff like that. But she laughs at me because. My first degree, when I first went to university, was actually in London, and it
Okay.
was at the School of Slavonic and East European Studies in the early 90s. So it was essentially, I got in late. It was the spy school. It was where they used to train
A
people
spy school? There is such a thing as a spy school?
to speak Russian. And I speak a little bit of Russian, but
Oh my.
it was too late. The Cold War had ended, and I missed that job of being a spy. I'd
Oh
probably be a
man.
you I'd be a useless spy, to be honest. But then again, I would say that, wouldn't
You would have to say that is
I?
true. Now it's kind of like, wait a minute, what's going on? No.
Oh my God, who's listening to this?
No,
Oh.
it's the funny thing is for the longest time, ask my husband, like, what do? You know, and there's only so much you can say. He's a cartographer and he works for
Right.
the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and he talks about all this stuff. And I'm like, he's a spy. You know, I'm just cut all of that. I'm like, he's just a spy. Like
Yeah.
it's just a joke. So
Well.
you are a creative writing professor right now, or were.
Yeah. Well, I they haven't bestowed the title they haven't given me the title of professor, but I am a yeah. I've been teaching. Well. In my early sort of career, I sort of did a little bit of dabble with it, but I do a lot more of it now. So I'm sort of researching as an academic and teaching as an academic in Liverpool John Moores University, which is the local sort of institution. People have been saying I belong in an institution for a while, so I'm just happy to kind of keep them happy, not
Ah,
in that
so
respect.
tell me how, as a teacher in creative writing, How has that helped or hurt your own writing and your own writing process?
That's a fascinating question, Shaz. I think it's something I sort of daily sort of noodle. I'm always thinking about, how does this sit next to each other? I mean, at the moment, I suppose a minute, I'm teaching. They've given me the because it's not an even spread of teaching across the year. So from the semester that runs from January through to April, I get a lot of stuff thrown at me. So I've got like, quite a few modules that I'm having to teach, and there's a big volume of students. And of course, young people come with a lot of challenges. They come with a lot of problems, and even more so these days. I found in the years I've been teaching, it's got harder and harder, to be perfectly frank. And I don't know if that's the situation that's reflected in the US, but here, the mental health thing since COVID has
Oh,
been very, very
100%.
difficult.
100%.
So, I mean, of course, I don't like to let them down. I want to give them everything I can. So that therefore means that I've got to be very, very careful with time management as well. For a number of years, and I'm officially a kind of carer to my wife as well, because she went through breast cancer. So it's kind of there's a lot of sort of other things in my life that I've got to sort of balance. I on the flip side of it, and this is kind of getting into the positive side of being a lecturer in creative writing. On the flip side, it's been a gift, really. It's given me, I've read thousands of scripts and other types of writing, because I do sort of digital writing, digital iterations of it, so I get them to go out and produce stuff and make stuff as well. But that is giving me a sort of really honed craft, to the extent that I have, my own techniques of putting something together, researching something, and sort of instilling it into my own work. It doesn't afford me a whole lot of time. But then again, I think, well, unless I'm, kind of a commissioned writer or a commissioned filmmaker, and you're kind of in that very small bracket, which is, you're working for a broadcaster or a production company or a streamer in that sense, then you're going to be doing something else to support this. There's a shocking statistic, which is the number of published novelists, and I am in that bracket. I am a published novelist, but the m number of published novelists who make a living out of it in the United Kingdom, per se, is roughly around between 10 and 15 people.
10 to
And
15 people out of how many? So what's the percentage? Are we talking like less than 1%?
Oh, absolutely tiny. And you can be a successful novelist, you can be selling thousands of books. And I know people who, I've got a friend of mine I do a podcast with, Mike Hollows, and he sold 60,000 books, which is good numbers. That's very good numbers for a book.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
And he writes about the Second World War and so forth. And he's doing his PhD. He's trying to get into, he's quite a bit younger than I am, but he's trying to get into academia because he knows that it's the great way to support storytelling and being a storyteller per se, is to be in the related field. I had it with filmmaking. I was lucky enough to be a kind of professional producer for a while. So I had those sort of, I was, there was a guy called David Morrissey who's on the front cover of Water Street, but he's an actor. He's worked with Nicolas Cage, and he was in Captain Corelli's Mandolin. He was in The Walking Dead and a few other things. And David's great. He's pretty well known over here as in television, but he's done a lot of really top line Hollywood stuff as well. And I was his producer for a while, and that was great. It was a great thing to do. I went all over the place, went to lots of film festivals. I had that kind of lifestyle where I was sort of involved with the film industry, but it was still difficult. The hours were crazy, and it was still tough, really tough. And I've retained that craft and those sort of contacts and that sort of know-how when it comes to making films, and I sort of instill it into this because I use it to kind of help market my books and everything. But I've got to be perfectly honest, I prefer to be the writer. I prefer to be that guy who's just like coming up with the world and just going, here it is. And if someone picks it up as a TV project, and I obviously would love that, but I think it's more likely to be a TV than the film project, but who knows. That's great, but as far as I'm concerned, I deliver the world. A novel is the most interactive form of writing, because when you're invested in it, you feel like you're in there. It's almost it is a little bit of an illusion you're creating, but you it's sort of the my particularly with Water Street, getting back to that Water Street, my whole aim is to kind of transport people in time and
You
take them
did.
there.
Absolutely. I was there. I could see it.
Thank
It
you.
looked great.
Thank you.
No, it
I
was
really
great. I'm like
appreciate that.
walking the streets there and all the poverty and all the stuff. I'm like, I was there. I was like, whoa. Okay, where am I? 1863. I'm like, great.
Absolutely. And for me, I suppose it's one of the big debates with historical fiction, but you could extend this to storytelling or in visual means, so film and TV. It is a debate. It's a debate worth having. A lot of historical thrillers or historical, even something like Downton Abbey or anything that's kind of set in a historical period. Do you make it, and I'm not a big fan of this word, but do you make it quote unquote relatable to now? So, or do you actually seek to tell an accurate, give an accurate de 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 depiction of that period? And for me, it's the latter. It always is, because actually, if you do that well, then it will be relatable automatically, because it's the human condition, and that doesn't change. People are people. People react the same way. People, there are banisters of that time who are around now, and there might be different sort of mores and social sort of conventions and norms and whatnot. But actually, it all maps. What sort of sometimes gets to me when I watch something or read something that is from a certain era, and they're trying to kind of shoehorn too many modern ideas, is I stopped believing it, and that for me is when I sort of the eye start to glaze over, or I start to get distracted by something else, what I'm having for tea, or
Well, that's important.
oh yeah, all the football the football scores, or how Liverpool FC are doing, or any of them. I start to kind of move away from being involved in that story, so I sort of know what I like and what I don't like. And inevitably, I live in 2024. That is the year last time I checked, isn't it? 2024.
Well, so far, that's what I heard, but
I kind of did the old Lang Syne thing a couple of weeks ago, but I think inevitably someone that's going to creep in, and whether it's the back of your mind, or in the occasional sort of phrase. And I use a bit of loose language in my piece, mainly because it's something I'm quite interested in, and this is from a very much a geeky point of view. Because I don't know if you've spotted this, Anas, but I am a geek. That's my thing. I just
I think as a writer, I think writers can be a little bit geeky and, with research and things like that. So a little bit,
I just, I'm terrible. I actually, I, again, I it's another thing I drive my wife crazy with, but I just, etymology is really interesting to me, and I think this is one of the reasons why I'm particularly fascinated with the mid 19th century, because in the mid 19th century, so many things were forming that we sort of take for granted now, and one of those things was, the concept of mass literacy. And actually, I think there's a Google site. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but you can go on it, and you can put a word into it and see how common it was in the particular era. Which would be a fascinating research tool, but I just need to point out to those clever people at Google that this actually refers to literature. It doesn't actually refer to how people spoke, because the vast majority of people couldn't read or write at the time. So, the way people spoke and the way language sort of, particularly, they look at the English language because it's so generic and across the world, and the formation of that language. Well, I'll give you an example. One of the characters is called, and I've sort of snuck it in there. It's not very subtle, but the Beatles names, because Beatles is connection with Liverpool. One of the characters' name is McCartney. His second name is McCartney. But in etymology terms, what would have happened and this happened quite frequently with people's names, is Irish names are anglicized. So the Irish language is very, very different to English. And so most Irish names, you meet anyone with an Irish name, that there's an Irish version of the name, and it's quite, you read it and think, you know, I don't quite understand that. Right. They still use that sort of Latin characters, but a lot of kind of interesting ways of spelling it. Anyway, McCartney was a kind of misinterpretation of the, and this is quite a common Irish name, much more common, McCarthy. McCarthy's came over, and no doubt some customs official who was in a hurry and getting someone to move down the line, you know, like an Ellis Island type scenario.
Right.
Just saw this. So what's your name? McCarthy.
McCartney, right? McCartney, yeah. Why not?
It's McCartney. McCarthy. Well, that's how we're going to write it down. And it's stuff like that. I've kind of just ignored that Google thing and even a lot of like 19th century literature, because, you know, so much of it is rooted in, you know, how we perceive it, and we're obsessed with the class system in this country, the upper classes. Mm-hmm. It's rooted in people who had the money to be literate, and it was seen as that's how it was seen. You know, it's like driving around in a Tesla these days. You know, you've got the money to be able to do it. You know,
right.
That's why you drive. It's just like that. You know, it's vast majority of people out there, because you were either in that sort of bracket, the middle class was sort of developing, mm-hmm. you know, particularly in that era, because you had all those sort of artisan industries that were growing. Mm-hmm. And Liverpool, again, is the perfect example of it, because so many of these things grew from the city, because there was the demand for it as ever. So, but literacy was something that was developing. So what I've attempted to do in the kind of dialogue of the book is to sort of reflect that and sort of use lots of Irish terms. So sort of, you know, usually insulting someone, because that's what they're very good at.
Right. You know, okay.
After drinking too much, it'd be the classic sort of, I'm going to throw this, you know, obviously lots of F-bombs in there. Like, you know, and people don't expect to see that in something that's set in 1863. But
right.
Again, looking into the etymology of the F-bombs have been around for a long time.
Really?
So, you know, yeah, it's an Anglo-Saxon sort of term that's sort of, you know, so, well, people don't expect to see that, you know. You might see it in Game of Thrones, but you certainly won't see it. Well, you would see it in Downton Abbey, that's for sure.
Right.
unless they have the producers have a complete brainwave for the next series or next film. So, yeah, so there's all these different aspects come into it. And, yeah, it's
what
interesting.
What makes a good book? What do you think makes a good book? You know how you said like less than 1% of the authors are able to sustain themselves with their writing.
Yeah.
How are they able to do it? What makes them different? Or is it just toss a coin? Is it just luck?
It's an interesting one, that, isn't it? Because I think I wouldn't necessarily equate, you know, absolute quality with that being in that bracket. Always. I mean, don't get me wrong, you must be doing something right to be able to, you know, because usually if you're making a living as an author and doing nothing else, and then you're doing something right, and you're hitting a certain market, and, you know, there's so many metrics that are attached to it, and publishers are really into this, you know.
Right.
And you know, it's an internet age thing, I would guess, you know, that they can really drill down audiences and kind of build up followings in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm trying to do the same thing with Water Street. That's what you have to do. I think over and above that, though, you know, you research well, and you kind of, part of the thing is to sort of build up that relationship with your reader, which, you know, never used to be the case. You know, you wouldn't see your readers. Now you're always talking to them, and rightly so. I think it's a great thing. I think, yeah, I don't know. I think what makes a great book for me, though, is something different. I think there's a heart and soul and an honesty that needs to be attached to it. You know, whether it's commercially successful or not is another thing. You know, there are plenty of writers out there who have not become authors. If you class an author as someone who's being actually published in some way, self-publishing sort of muddies the waters still, because, you know, again, you can do that either very badly or very well. You know, there are plenty of people on the New York Times bestseller list who are who are self-published, and they've cracked it, and they know how to play the whole system and create a sort of industry from what they do, and they make a living from it, you know. So maybe there's more than that 10 or 15 that are actually out there that we don't know about because they're self-published. I'm talking about the people who are kind of got the deals with the, you know, the kind of big multinational publishers, you know, the kind of HarperCollins to this world, the Hachette to this world, you know,
The big
those
five,
people,
the big five.
the famous Big Five. Yeah. So I think it's, I think, you know, if you're setting your stall out to be a writer who writes novels and gets them out there, and whatever your measure of success is based upon that, then you what you do is you start from what's in there, and what's in there, you know, what do you feel? I mean, certainly with Water Street and its follow-up, there's no, I find it easier to write because it's based upon stuff that I'm very, very interested in. You know, I've sort of dabbled with the idea, and I don't know lots of people here because there's some TV shows which are kind of, I suppose, soap operas that are produced in the region. So I know lots of people, and I've sort of dabbled, worked, done little bits of work here and there, but I couldn't do that. And I don't buy it. And I say this to my students: never look down on someone who works for a soap opera, because for one thing, they get better paid than you probably ever will do in anything else. And for another thing, there is actually, you know, not necessarily my cup of tea, as it were. It's not necessarily my preference, but to watch. But you know, my wife watches them, and you know, there's a craft attached, and there's a real discipline, and you've got to be good at what you do, you know, for better or worse. So I think there's always that kind of that line, and this exists in screenwriting as well, and the film industry and TV industry, where, you know, are you writing something that's kind of artful and worthy, or are you writing something that's gonna put bums on seats and make people, you know, kind of appeal to the masses? You know, you ask some people, they want to hedge their bets and go, oh yeah, I want to do both, you know, of course I want to do both. But I'm like, well, you know, I think you can only ever start with something that's close to your heart, you know, something that has a, and everyone's experience is different. Everyone's, you know, I'm a firm believer, like this thing about, you know, a lot of the kind of ideas we have in society about intelligence and how that is an absolute rubbish. You know, they don't have any foundation, and they kind of, some of them are quite toxic and dangerous actually, you know, kind of, you know, in attaching it to certain groups and people with certain backgrounds. I'm very passionately believe that everyone has got a book in them of some kind, or a story to tell, you know, everyone, you know,
So,
whether you.
you know, if everyone has a story to tell, right? Here is the, you know, you've got a story and you've got a writer, okay? So, if you've got, everyone's got a story to tell, can they write that story? And or can a writer, someone who's good at writing but doesn't have a story, kind of come up with a story and make it? Do you see what I'm saying? Which way is better and how does that all work out? What do you think?
As soon as I say one way, someone turns around immediately and does it the other way and does it better.
So tell them the other
So,
way, so they will do it the way you
yeah,
want.
I think if there's a commonality with the whole thing, Shanaz, I think what it is for me is, you know, someone who's willing to run through walls to make it happen. And whatever way, you know, whether you're making a 5-minute short film or whether you're doing a kind of huge epic, I wouldn't recommend that your first novel would be anything over 80,000 words, by the way, because no one's going to publish it. But you
What
know,
is that?
you get my, I know it's an obsession. It's a bit like if you're an independent filmmaker and it's over, like, you know, 90 minutes or 100 minutes or whatever, you know, it's difficult to get it in front of a sales agent or someone like that. It's that mentality that's just there. And it's crazy, but you know, I think you've got to sort of, I say this to my students, just sort of be wary of that, you know, because I've met people who've just, you know, gone and done fundraisers for the films, you know, sort of crowdfunding and whatnot, and just beg, borrow, stole, and just, you know, bled a film, literally bled a film, and ended up, you know, making something that is just not very good. And it's not because they're not very good, you know, separate yourself from the work.
Okay.
It's just, you know, they've just given themselves too hard a task, and therefore it, or even, I mean, I know these guys, and I won't mention their name or what they did, but they made this film, and it was patently, obviously, 20 minutes too long. And I could
Okay.
see, you could sit there watching. I said, look, it's 20 minutes too long, but you know, all you need to do is this, this, and this, and they didn't do it. And they can't get a distributor, and they're complaining about it. And so I'm like, well, you know, I told you.
Right,
And
right,
it's not
right,
good,
right.
not because I'm particularly intelligent, but I've got the power, I've got the sort of, yeah, the benefit of perspective. And that's so much
Right.
what I do that with my students all the time. And I think, yeah, of course, there are no hard and fast answers, but if you're willing to run through walls and again, I use a lot of film analogies because that's
Sure.
sort of what I
Fine.
began my career in. You know, Roger Corman said it really well, that the kind of famous B movie director who kind of started the career of Scorsese and Spielberg and a lot of and Lucas, people like that. He said, you know, make your first film in a haunted house. And I think that's a beautiful expression because, yes, it might not necessarily have to be a haunted house. If you're making a romantic comedy or you're making a kind of earnest social drama, it would be. But just, you know, really set your stall out and work within a certain box. You know what your parameters are, because you can create beautiful work by doing that. You know, just keep it simple. You know, you can still have interesting, complex characterization and all the things that are going to make us want to either read or tune into that story. But you know, keep it pretty modest and simple, and that way, you know. You've got an opportunity. There's no surefire way of doing it, of course, but you've got an opportunity to interest some people and get people reading your stuff or get people watching your stuff. I think there's truth in that. You know, I know some people have got epic stories they want to tell, and that I have students doing it. It drives me crazy. I say, go and write and research a 10-minute film, but do that properly. You know, don't just write it and just hope, you know, give me the first draft and go, I'm a genius, because that's never going to happen. You
Right.
know, but just what you do is you go away and if you find primary sources. So yeah, Google something for sure. But you know, everyone can Google a certain subject. Where you really get the gold is you actually go and approach those people, those subjects, people who know about that stuff, you know, and find out, because then you're finding out something that no one else knows. And that adds to your story, and then that's something you've got to offer, you know. And it's just, this is all craft that I've just sort of picked up over the years, and sort of my little kind of beady-eyed viewpoint on things. Like, you know, I just think, you know, well, you know, but the you know, getting back to the point about overdoing it, you know, some of these students, and not all of them, some of them really are clever and they get on it, and they very often teach me things. And but some of them will go, they'll try and squeeze a huge concept into a 10-minute film. And I'll be like, well, what have you done there? Let's have a look at this. You've actually succeeded in telling us nothing as a result. And it sounds harsh to say that, but I understand, you know, someone's got this big, burning, passionate idea that they want to get across, but I've given them 10 minutes to do it in, and they've just managed to give us this kind of blob of nothing. And it's just, there's no drama in it, there's no intrigue, you know, and they've forgotten about all that stuff because they've just got so carried away in world building, you know, which is the kind of the problem with science fiction in a lot of ways, you know. But it infects a lot of other genres as well, which is, you know, I'm going to give you this piece of information, you really need to know this, and one way or another I'm gonna shoehorn this in, and you're gonna, whether you like it or not, I'm gonna tell you this. And of course, the person who's reading it's just going, yeah,
Get
okay,
with the story. Get on with the story.
yeah, I know, I don't really want to read this now, or you know, and that's the last thing you want to do. You've got to intrigue. You got, and it's harder for someone who's a perceived new writer. You know, and this is the thing, she has, you know, my agents, she turns around, and my publishers, they turn around and go, I'm a debut author. Now, I could be insulted by that. I could go, well, I beg to differ. I've been around for a long time and bloody, bloody, well, and here's my ego. Well, I'm going to go, what the hell? You're insulting me. I'm going to sack you and find another
Well, yeah,
publisher.
that wouldn't work out too well, but
Well, exactly. And if my publisher and my agents, who are lovely, are listening to this, of course, that is not the case. But you can cut your nose off in spite of your face, and many people do, they, because they get too attached to it, and they forget the kind of fundamental tenet that someone else has got to read this. You're a writer, and it's a two-way thing. It's a symbiotic relationship. Whoever's reading this, how are you going to get them to connect with it? You've got to intrigue them. It's a fun, for me, it's part of how fiction works, how storytelling works, how drama works. It's about just keeping them going, and not necessarily, and it doesn't have to be a blunt instrument, but there's a story, again, historical. I'll go back to Charles Dickens, who's a particular favorite of mine because he had a social conscience. As a human being, he actually did some things which are, with his family, but that's another story. But just in terms of his content, Charles Dickens has got a connection with Liverpool, and actually one of the settings in the book, The Bridewell, he was that's a real place. That's actually a bar. So if you ever come to Liverpool, I invite you to go to The Bridewell and show you around there.
Excellent, excellent. Look forward to it.
It's an old police jail, and it's actually very, very intimidating to look at. It's kind of big, thick brick walls, and it's kind of this edifice. It just kind of gets you. But there's a plaque outside, and in 1861, which was 2 years before Water Street is set, Charles Dickens came to Liverpool, and they appointed him a special constable, and he spent some time in this police jail, obviously researching something. Yeah, so for me, Dickens is a fundamental influence, and he was probably one of the first. He serialized his novels to begin with, so that's how he started, got going. And the novel was still seen as a new form. You had certain people obviously Shelley with Frankenstein, Mary Shelley, and the Brontes, who were well known, and others who were bringing the novel as a form. That kind of length of story was becoming popularized through and being published. But Dickens sort of was operating in a different sort of sphere. He was connected with Punch magazine, and that kind of, so it was sort of seen as really quite pulpy. This is sound it sounded bizarre, because many people look at Dickens now and go, "Oh, that's serious stuff. That's really classical stuff." Well, at the time, it wasn't. It was he wrote for the people. He wrote about the people, for the people. And he obviously had a certain bracket of reader, because again, I'll go back to that thing about literacy being very limited. But his whole thing, and again, I'll say this to students, is the origin of the cliffhanger. Really, he had to. He knew that his editor for Punch magazine would demand that at the end of every section that he give chapter or whatever, he'd have to leave something to keep people reading. So it's like it's the old thing. Tune in next week for that thing.
What happens next?
And of course, now it's sort of everywhere, isn't it? It's you only have to turn on Stranger Things, and that's what it's all about. It's kind of keep watching, and we're going to keep you hanging on for the next season, and throw this in at the end. And well, that Dickens was doing that in the 1850s, 1860s. So it's not a new thing, but I think it's stood the test of time, that type of storytelling, and that sort of, well, that isn't necessarily a type of storytelling, but that method, that sort of the idea that you've got to intrigue people. And it's what most new writers completely miss. They completely miss that idea is just not there at all. They get so tied up in their own semantics and the clever language and the clever ideas, and they miss the whole thing about going, right, well, I'm gonna rope you in, and I'm not gonna let you go. And that's kind of what I that that's sort of something I just keep trying to do. And whether I succeed or not, I don't know. That's down to the other people who read it. But it's something I deliberately try to do. I have fun with it, actually. I always do when I start writing something. Whether it's a chapter or whether it's a plan it out. Whether I'm an architect or a gardener, as it were, so whether I actually really kind of think about structure all the way through or whether I just kind of wing it. And the answer to that is a little bit of both. I always think, it's always at the back of my mind, how am I going to, what's my coda? Where am I going to get, when am I going to get to where I'm just going to completely wreck someone's head? And just go, it's, as I say, it's just, it's my beady little geeky brain. And, you know, that's how I am.
Very, very, very cool. So how do you get an agent?
How do you get an agent? That's a really good question. Yeah, I my particular experience of agents are very, very positive, actually. I've had a few interesting sort of, I've seen it from every side, actually. I mean, okay, I'll start with answering the question directly, and then I'll maybe sort of look at sort of the reasons for agents existing, and there are very, very important reasons in my view for that. You get an agent by obviously doing all those things that I've just been speaking about. So, you know, really kind of writing something that you're passionate about, something that has a story underneath as well, preferably, because if there's a connection, absolutely, because it's the connection with the real world, you know. So I suppose it's story in the sense of, you know, how a journalist might see it. So, you know, someone who go, oh, right, okay, this, I didn't know that in 1863, there were, you know, across the Atlantic Ocean, that, you know, part of the American Civil War was going on. You know, again, going back to my obsession there, the American Civil War actually ended in Liverpool. Boom. There's another one on the steps of the town hall.
That is huge. Yes.
On the steps of the town hall. That's when the final surrender happened. Anyway, moving away from that for a moment, this just shows you how, you know, it's about being, having something that you're passionate about. Because at the end of the day, the agent's thinking, right, they've got to sell something within whatever industry they're in. So they're in film or TV, and they are slightly different. There are distinctions between a literary agent and a film and TV agent. Mm-hmm. But if they're in film or TV, they've got to think about how they can kind of connect the writer to, you know, the appropriate talent and the appropriate, or the work to the appropriate talent and to the producer. If they're a literary agent, then they're thinking about how they can connect that work to an appropriate publisher, and it's difficult for them, and they've got a really tough thing, because if they don't do that, they don't get paid. Simple as that. You know, so they have to be good at what they do,
right,
in order to, so that they've got to, this is just, you know, writers, if they put themselves in the shoes of the agent for a second, will learn so much, and therefore be able to kind of backwards engineer it into how they work, into their craft.
Right.
Because, you know, not all agents are good, don't get me wrong. Some are, you know, draconian. Some will, you know, not do the work for the, no. Some will value some clients over others. You know, some of these things do happen, but, you know, think in the most positive way. Start off by doing that, and that will help you get an agent. So go, right, okay, I'm going to put myself in their shoes. They want to sell a piece of work. You know, it's, at the end of the day, it's an industry. It's about, you know, in that sense, about money, vulgar as that might be, but it is. So, you know, they want to sell that work. You know, they've got to like you. They've got to like you as a writer. They've got to like you, you know, in terms of, you know that that you're going to put the work into something. Mm-hmm. But more than that, I would say they've got to know that you're invested in that idea. So wherever the work's coming from, and that idea itself is saleable from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, this comes down to selection as well, because, and you'll see, you know, you get the Writers and Artists Yearbook, which is, I don't know if you got this in the States, but it's a big red book which has a list of every.
I think everything's online now. Thing.
Yeah, you probably find this information online, but it's still quite a handy book. I mean, you can get it as an ebook as well. The good thing is it just conflates all this information, so you've got, you know, every literary agent in the US and mm-hmm. and the UK. You wanted to approach them, but anyway, you know, wherever you find that information from, do your homework on them. Just, you know, so again, another way of snagging an agent. Because, by the way, most publishers worth their salt will only commission or buy a work, sign up for a book, that if it's gone through an agent. And this is often down to these sort of interpersonal relationships, quite close relationships that are developed over time between editors and publishing houses and agents. And some might say, you know, well, it's a bit of a closed shop as a result. and it's difficult to penetrate. And you'd be right by saying that, but you've just got to spend the time. You've just got to, nurture this. And, if your work has got that kind of, sounds a bit fancy down, but, if your work has got that kind of emotional honesty that you can attach to it, and that kind of drive, and, as I say, fundamentally, that story that is sellable, mm-hmm. both in terms of, it could be a news item, it could be something that ultimately you could see sitting in the blurb on a Netflix show.
Okay.
it's something that, if I read this, I would want to watch it, that kind of thing. And it's understanding that, being a writer, being an author, and again, I think this maps to screenwriting just as neatly. Being someone who does that is not just about writing novels, or it's not just about writing screenplays. It's actually understanding that there's a whole plethora of documents, including how you market yourself,
right,
that connects with all this. And if you understand that, and if you're willing to spin those plates and sort of, and actually maybe especially these days with social media, do that sort of self-promotion, which, it doesn't always sit that well with being a writer. My students laugh at me for this, but I say I'm an introvert. If I had the choice, my head would be buried in the sand. I'd be this, this kind of hermit that just occasionally appeared to go down the pub. That's what I'd be. But I haven't got that choice. I'm in the middle of this as much as anyone. I've only formed an opinion on this because I've been lucky enough to I've seen a few things and know them. Including our mutual friend John Nimmons. I formed an opinion on this. I might be wrong. I'm happy to be proved wrong. But I think if you want to snag an agent, then it's important to know as much as you can about that particular person. And because, there's no point approaching someone if you're writing science fiction and they're into, creative nonfiction.
Right.
So do some research, know your genres. Of course, what you're doing, you might well feel like it'll be the most original thing known. And there's nothing wrong with being original. It's a great thing. But, sort of understand what sort of bracket it sits in because, again, going to publishing, or like them or loathe them, is the big Bezos bazaar, as I call them. There's young Jeffrey who, is obsessed with sending phallic-shaped rockets into space, but his main area of business actually began in books, Amazon, and Amazon, you can buy anything from Amazon now, and not everyone likes them. I'm not 100% invested in myself, but I have, for my sins, got an Amazon account. Most people have. Majority of people out there are going to buy your book have, and that's where the book is sold. Now, I'm about to do, there's a kind of quite a big sort of book selling chain here called Waterstones. I'm going to do an event in Waterstones on February the 5th.
That's awesome.
7:30 UK time.
Okay. I'd have to take a flight, but
Yeah. Oh, well, you're more than welcome. You're more than welcome. I'll just show you around the city and show you. I love the idea. I think bookstores are a massively valuable thing. And, go and hang out with them. You will learn so much. You learn as much from sitting in the bookstore as you will in the library. And I also am a massive fan of libraries as well. I think they have a huge function to the community.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, as far as publishers are concerned, Amazon is the be all and end all. All this other stuff is great, but if your book's going to sell, well, it's going to sell on Amazon. And their algorithm is all linked to genre. So, it's all tuned into what the publisher puts in mm-hmm. for what that genre is and what that perceived audience is. And that data has been drilled down so much. Mm-hmm. And I suppose there's the value in trying to go for one of the big five is that they have access to all this data. They have their, through their other writers, that one of their core areas of business and marketing is to know who those readers are and how they map to a particular genre because they can go out and find them like that. Whereas if you're on your own self-publishing, you've got to do that work right from scratch.
Right. So,
and you'll know also that agents have a kind of connection with this as well. Many agents are ex-editors themselves, so they'll know they'll know the publishing industry inside out, and they'll go to the big events. You know, you have the World event in Frankfurt, the Frankfurt Book Fair. You have them in the US. You have them in London over here. You know, my agent's Liverpool Literary Agency, so she's mm-hmm. She sprang up during the pandemic, and she's actually a former student of the place of teaching. So, and she's brilliant, Claire Coombs. She's absolutely amazing. She's she works from home. She's got a family, cat. All of these things, which always appears on. I've become well acquainted with the cat rear end on a Zoom call. but you know, this is how people operate, and it's great. You know that can happen, because traditionally most agents. I used to have an agent in London when I started out my career. I was lucky enough to snag an agent, and they were based in London. I suppose if you could map the same thing to LA or New York in the US, you know, where you've got New York being the center of publishing and LA being the center of film and television. I think in order to snag an agent, it's important to try and understand these things. You don't have to know everything. You don't have to know everyone. You just need to understand where your little corner of the earth is and focus on that and really target them, because, you know, I don't think you can get anywhere without an agent, to be frank.
Right.
I think it's possible if you're really savvy and you want to go direct to your readers, and if you're clever and if you want to learn to build a career in self-publishing and not need an agent. And then, you know, you bring the mountain to Muhammad, and yeah, why not? But I think for the better part, you need an agent. An agent, when you've got a good agent, will support you. They'll provide, you know, sometimes painful feedback, because you need that objectivity. I'm that guy, as I said at the start of this sort of this bit talking about agents. I'm that guy who sort of sits on the other side of the table, so I know what it's like. And you know, I've had agents as a producer who have been hard-assed. You know, they've protected the writer to the nth degree, to the extent that a film was very nearly canned as a result, and we had the finance and everything. And the writers were, you know, so stoked to have their film getting made. And I had the agent, I was crying, you know, the agent was just insisting on impossible things, because he was trying to drive a hard bargain. And at the end of it, he got a better deal for his writers than he would have done if he had just gone, oh, yeah, we'll love what you're doing. Yeah, go ahead. You know, he drove a hard bargain, and he because he knew that we couldn't give him some of the things he was asking for. Mm. It was just the kind of, he was softening us up, and this is the this is the sort of, you know, the thing, and this goes on in LA all the time. I know for a fact it goes on in LA all the time. You have these agents who are just, you know, playing games, and you know, and they're experts at doing this, because they're not just dealing with the writer, they're dealing with talent, they're dealing with producers, and they're playing it in their favor. You know, but with the literary agents, yeah, that's what they are good at doing. They're good at driving hard bargains when they know how to, you know, if one publisher gets interested in your book, the first thing an agent will do, I'll ask you that. What's the first thing an agent does if they find out a publisher's interested in your book?
I have no idea. What would an agent do?
Well, the first thing an agent does is he lets all the other publishers know that publisher is interested in the book.
So there could be a auction.
Yeah.
Potentially.
So if you get some stale bread and throw it into your garden or your yard, and you can sit there watching it. And I used to do things like this as a kid, because I don't know, I'm weird like that. you watch the stale bread, and one swallow or one bird will land and start to peck away at it. You'll notice that within seconds, all the other birds will be there.
Other birds will come in.
That's how agents work with publishers. They'll use the, and same thing in film and TV. Actually, I found that, you know, if you snag the interest of one producer, they're not going to go, oh great, I'll take your hand off for that, because that's where the real money is, as far as they see. Like, you know, you'll sell some books, but if someone, you know, you get a movie deal, or you get a TV deal, then that's happy days. You know, what they'll do is go, right, okay, that's a great offer. Leave it with me. Put the phone down. Pick the phone up. Hey, guess what? This is how they make the money. This is how they work, and this is how they've always worked. And whether you're at the film or TV agents, or whether they're the literary agents, that's how they work. And, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of it is for the benefit of the clients. I'm absolutely sure it's for the benefit of them. But, you know, they're not in, it's not a charity. They're not in business. It's not altruism. They're doing it right. Because they're cute, you know. And I don't mean cute as in the little fluffy teddy bear sort of cute. the cute minded. So, you know, there's a little bit of an agent from my perspective. I've seen it from both sides. And, you know, yeah, not all of them are to your taste. And some of them can be quite dismissive and uneven. But I think a problem quite a few writers do have is they take everything personally. So, and I know this because I'm on the other side of the table when
right,
it comes to offering constructive criticism. And I am very, very careful, particularly with young people. You know, I don't turn around and go, something's not very good. I don't just slag something off and go, this is never going to work. Because I know that, you know, there is a connection between the writer, and doesn't matter who the writer is, actually. You know, if someone tells you that your work is not good, or that it's not working for them, and this can happen with someone who's, you know, this can happen with Neil Gaiman, or this can happen with Margaret Atwood or anyone like that,
right,
you know,
right, sure.
Where, you know, everyone's a critic, you know, and you can say, oh, I don't care, but ultimately you do. And if you're someone who's kind of young and vulnerable, or even just vulnerable, you know, you don't have to be young necessarily,
right?
You know, it can really affect you. It can knock you, and it can put you off it. And I think, you know, again, going back to that core question of yours, Shana, so which is, you know, how to get an agent. Teflon skin, you know.
Teflon skin, okay.
Yeah, recognize that you're you might be upset. You know, if you need to, go into a kind of big open space and scream. And then come back.
I'll just invest in Kleenex and just cry.
Exactly. Yeah. Invest in Kleenex. That's it. Yeah. Absolutely. Kleenex. You know, because if you're going to get anywhere, that's going to happen. Someone's going to say no.
Right.
The thing is now, and I've noticed this is sort of something that has changed, I think. It used to be quite a blunt thing. And this is sort of, I'm going back to sort of pre. The internet might have been around, but before the internet was so popularized and before social media was so popularized. These days, these so-called gatekeepers of the industry, and I think that's quite a cruel expression to attach to an agent, actually, but people who can kind of help your career in that sense, they're very, very clear about when you can submit to them, if at all. And they have to be very precise in terms of the boundaries that they create for themselves, because they know that, you know, social media is, someone can easily, it can get quite abusive sometimes. So there's that. So it's respecting that, respecting the boundaries, but also knowing that, you know, an agent will have a subjective opinion on something. An agent will be looking for a certain thing. And your thing might be someone else's thing. It might be another agent's. It might not be theirs. And they might come to you. If they come back to you with a couple of pages of feedback and it's the death of 1,000 cuts, it's like what, you know, famously Stanley Kubrick did to Stephen King's draft of The Shining, where he absolutely ripped it. And I tell students about that, and I go, Stephen King's the most successful author on the planet.
Right.
And Stanley Kubrick completely destroyed his, he actually ended up making it as a film. So, you know,
well,
you know, still, but it's a good example. And there are numerous other examples of it. If someone's going to take the time to actually assassinate your work, then they care. And it's actually a really positive sign. And it's difficult to tell yourself something when the air's being let out the balloon and someone's rejected you. You know, it's a little bit like the mafia. You know, the mafia, the assassins come with smiles on their faces. You know, what often happens now is because agents know this, and they'll say, really, really liked your work. Thanks for submitting it. Sometimes they'll give you a standard sort of letter saying, no thanks. You know, others will go, really liked your work. It didn't quite work for us, you know, and you won't find out anything more than that, really. You won't know if they've read it even, or if they've read the first page, or, you know, if there's any kind of connection. Sometimes, interestingly, you get a little bit more when you've actually got an agent, because what happens then is those agents have got good relationships with editors, and the editor will take the time to go and read something for a start properly. And give you feedback and go, you know what, this wasn't for us for this reason. Here are the positive points. You know, I'm probably, I've heard this often said, I'm probably wrong and this will be a bestseller and whatnot. But so once you get past that level of having an agent, then you're more likely to get detailed feedback. But feedback is available to you, whether you have an agent or whether you don't. If you don't have an agent, there are ways of doing this. And this is another possible way to get an agent, is to kind of get people to read your stuff. So, you know, maybe in that, to that extent, self-publishing can work as well. But, you know, have a sort of rigor attached to it. You know, don't make silly spelling mistakes. Format it correctly, whether you're writing a screenplay or whether you're writing a novel. Get your formatting right, you know, because people have expectations. You know, they might not be formatting sticklers in the sense and understand how formatting works, but subconsciously you'll know if a paragraph's in the wrong place or if the dialogue's wrong. You know, this is it. You know, most of my screenwriting students, because I teach some screenwriting modules, they use apps, so they'll use like Celtex or Final Draft or Trilby or any of those things. And I'm like, fine, you know, they all kind of pretty much work in the same way. You know, don't pay for it, I tell them, like, but yeah, because it only really comes into play once you get something to the production. We use Final Draft. But, you know, they think, ah, oh, great, got it solved now. I'm using the app, no problem. That work's done for me. And I'm saying, no, you can still make those mistakes. You can still get a scene heading wrong. You can still, and as soon as that happens, then people will pick up on these little errors. And they'll be distracted by them, and then you break the dream. And the last thing you want to do when someone's reading your story is break the dream
Break the
in any
dream.
way, shape, or form. So, you know, there's stuff like that. You know, get a core of people to read your stuff. This is why sometimes, not always, you've got to be quite discerning on this. It's, I suppose, it's one of the advantages of doing a degree or a course in some form of creative writing. Be careful with that. And I know I teach it myself, so I don't want to kind of destroy my own intake in a sense, but it's all about building this sort of tribe around you and a creative community, and being part of that creative community and finding people that you trust and trust massively. So I would rather someone gave me 2 pages of, you know, Death of a Thousand Cuts, as I call it, than someone went, oh, I loved your work, it was great. I'm like, okay,
It doesn't help you.
what bit did you like about my work? Then tell me. And sometimes I'll even throw something in there that wasn't true. So yeah, let's say for Water Street, you know, I'll go, did you like the bit where Abraham Lincoln turned up in Liverpool?
Wait,
Do you
he
like
wasn't
that
there
bit?
in Water Street.
Exactly. He wasn't there in Water Street.
Wasn't there in Water Street.
I'll throw that in as a trick to people. I'll go, because I want to make sure that they've read it. You know, because if they say, oh yeah, I love that bit. Yeah, that was great when
Well,
he,
it
that
was
was a real,
great. I love the speech he gave.
I was a real, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then he went on the carousel and he was dancing through the field with some daisies in his hand. Like,
There
yeah,
you
oh
go.
yeah, I love them. Yeah. But, you know, it is. And it's not that you don't, you know, I don't want to give people a reason to distrust other people, but that there's a lot of white noise out there now. You know, it's quite actually quite difficult to sit down and read anything, especially if you're just reading it for the purpose of pleasure. You're reading it because you like reading and you want to get away from the internet for a bit, and you want to get away from, even I even say it, like, you know, from your Netflix and your Amazon Prime and your Hulu and all these other things. You know, you want to get away from that white noise. You want to get away from social media, and you just want to kind of escape, you know, go back to 1863 or go and sample a different culture, or, you know, get into an issue that you're really passionate about. It's a real challenge for a writer to do that, because, you know, to write something that's that involved, that, you know, that's what you really want to do. And all of these things factor into that kind of golden thing of getting an agent and taking that step. I think it's, you know, and even successful writers are constantly looking at that and analyzing it and going, you know, and your measure of success is what? Well, someone says they like your book. That's a success.
That is true.
That's simple as that. You make some money out of it. Maybe that's a measure of success. You're able to go and talk to people about it. You know, that's a measure of success. I think you probably want to look at the reasons why you're doing it as well. Are you doing it because you want to make lots of money? Same answer I would give to a filmmaker. Go and work in a bank. You want to make lots of money? Go and work in the stock exchange. Learn how to sell used cars. Whatever you're going to do, whatever's going to make money, trade in Bitcoin, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's the modern answer to that. That if you want to make money, do that. If you want,
Right.
if you want to actually explore your craft, and don't get me wrong, this business, if you do the right things and you bust the right moves, can be like any other business, can be rewarding. And I do know, I've got examples of a friend of mine. She produced Bridgerton, which was did really well. It was like top selling series on Netflix. I don't know if you saw that in the States, but when she was on the same sort of level as me as a producer and was just struggling, staying in hostels and in Berlin to kind of, staying in campsites to go to the Cannes Film Festival and, schlepping it out in LA, like, to try and get to AFM. And, these stories are common, struggling, really, but getting there eventually and doing well. And it can happen. It can happen, but it's not the reason you go into it. It
Right.
can't be. I don't think so anyway. And I do sometimes. I used to have a master's course. I don't actually teach on it now. I teach the younger ones generally, to get the older, mature students. I used to teach the masters in screenwriting, and you get lots of people coming forward for that, saying, "This is a good deal, this isn't it?" Like, I sell a film script, I can make a lot of money, can't I? Like, and I just look at them and go, "All right, you've just said that to me. I'm not going to tell you otherwise, because you've just said that to me. If you didn't
Right.
volunteer that information, I might say, don't do this if your only reason is you're going to make lots of money.
Right.
But because you've just told me that, I'm just going to nod and smile. And if you do, I'll see you in 5 years' time. I'll shake your hand. I really will."
Right.
I have had students who've gone out and made a living out of screenwriting
That's awesome.
and done well, and I'm very proud of them. Not one of them said that. Not one of them. Not one of them. And I doubt one of those people who say that, and you do occasionally get them, will ever, to my mind. I think, and I think it's putting the cart before the horse, or not putting the cart before the horse. It's actually saying to yourself, I'm passionate about writing stories, and this could lead me in that direction. It could lead me in that direction. It could do this. It could do that. I haven't got any control over that, in a sense. I've got a little bit of control, I suppose, because I can choose about the people that I approach. Going back to the agent question again, I can choose about the people I surround myself as well.
Right.
I love actors. I'm just doing the audio book for Water Street at the moment. Quick plug for this guy because he's amazing. He does a lot of voiceover for commercials and for he does a lot of games work. So he's a character actor. So he's this Irish guy. He actually lives in Liverpool, and he is the man of a thousand voices.
Oh,
Now
wow.
there's a character as a sort of, besides Bannister, as the sort of bet in the world of Water Street, because I thought it was important to get across a sort of Republican stroke federal union
Right.
character who wasn't such a nice guy, and that's this butler guy who's based on
Right.
a real person, Benjamin Butler. Definition of how much you can hate someone, and this is the real guy. The citizens of New Orleans actually put his image on the bottom of chamber pots. That's a true story.
No,
This is
okay.
he was the governor of New Orleans in occupation. So there was this little enclave in the south that the Union occupied during the Civil War. Anyway, going forward to the audiobook, and this is something that very recently, only yesterday, we were recording it because I took him into the studio. I'm very sort of hands on with that. And Trevor, his name is, he said, "What accent do you want for him?" I was like, "Oh, well, he's Bostonian, so I suppose, can you do a sort of New England accent?" And that's a big ask for someone who's Irish, who lives in Liverpool, to go and do a Bostonian accent. He said, "Well, can you be more specific on this?" But I said, "I suppose a cross between JFK and Mayor Quimby from The Simpsons, because JFK, Mayor Quimby from The Simpsons, is actually, his voice is based on JFK's." Okay, I can do that. Irish American, sort of Bostonian. Yeah, I can do that. And he worked it a little bit, and then he threw in a bit of Orson Welles as well. And I mean, I don't know how many films you've seen with Orson Welles in, but Orson Welles was a master, and he was
Not
actually,
many.
for me, his bad guys were the classic roles. So Citizen Kane, even though he's a central character, he was kind of very sinister sort of guy. And the third man, he was brilliant as Harry Lime. He was this kind of unscrupulous bastard, to be honest. He was this guy who was just taking advantage of the wartime or post-war economy, and he was selling dodgy drugs that were killing people, dodgy pharmaceuticals, and he was on the run. And there's an amazing speech that takes place in The Big Wheel, and it's Orson Welles with his power. You know, A Touch of Evil is another one. You know, and these are sort of references that are probably long forgotten, but there was a resonance in this guy's voice, and Trevor got onto it straight away.
Wow.
And it was his idea. It wasn't my idea. It just, you know, it sort of lit the touch paper for me. I'm listening to someone else input on this. So, you know, and this is stuff I'm kind of learning, you know, right now, you know, I'm learning the value of doing something as an audio book.
Oh, I love audiobooks. I love audiobooks.
I think that they're amazing. And there's actually a very distinct and strong market and a growing market for it, little bit like there is for podcasts. You know, people like to be able to just, you know, go for a run or sit on the train or commute or whatever. And they don't want to actually strain their eyes. They want to just listen it's a great way to transport it. So I think another thing you can do, and you can even do this again if you're just developing it for self-publishing, is to get your work in front of actors. I suppose in the sense of doing a screenplay, it would be a table read, wouldn't it? You know, where you get a bunch of actors together, and you could, you know, a great sort of byproduct of the pandemic is that people work this way. And actually, I've done it a few times where I've done table reads with like certain projects that I've had up and running. And they're great, you know, you hear thing. Once you hear the word spoken, it's different from what it is on the page. So it will affect how you sort of think about it. You know, I do often read even prose work, you know, the novels, Water Street particularly. I'll read it out aloud. My wife will think, she'll be in the next room, she'll think I've finally fallen off the perch. You know, John's ready to go to be carted away. It's finally happened. He's finally gone. That's it. Like, you know, he's sort of, you know, screaming at someone in this kind of strange accent. But I do that myself, and I've got a face for radio, and I never really regarded myself as an actor. I don't mind it a bit, and I don't mind putting myself in front of a camera because I do that. I'm a bit gobby, to use an expression, a local expression. But, you know, really, actors, if you find good actors, and they're not actually that hard to find good actors, you know, you can go to local theatres, you can find out a lot of them on the internet, you can find groups. Writers and actors get together, make friends, you know. It's no coincidence you see really successful, again, I go back to film because it's sort of a bit of an obsession, but successful filmmakers, and they tend to, actors and filmmakers, if they're not the same people, tend to bring each other along, and the careers sort of develop in sync. It's all to do with having the tribe and getting your tribe together. So, you know, even if you are writing, you know, with the idea of ultimately being published, and you know, it's not dramatic writing, it's literary writing, you can still connect, and actors are great for that, because actors are, if you get a good actor, they will be able to give you more information about that character than most of your beta readers or, you know, other people that might just read it, you know, because they'll understand characters. It's a stock and trade of a good actor to understand character.
Right.
You know, it's the bottom line for them. Right. So, you know, even if you're writing in a different format of story, an actor will always, and another thing as well, most actors, especially ones who, you know, they have a similar problem to writers in that it's very difficult to get paid work. In some senses, it's even harder.
Yes.
I mean, my friend Trevor was saying, he's very, very clever. He's very entrepreneurial. So he'll go out and do voiceover work for games, and he's set up a home studio, and he'll do all kinds of stuff. But he'll still be in a department store playing Santa Claus at Christmas. Mm. You know, he'll still do those gigs that will pay, because he knows he has to, like, you know. And it's exactly the same principle as what I was saying before with writers. But most actors will be interested in you if you approach them and go, Or even put out a cat. You could even put out a casting call and just be straight and say, "Look, I haven't got any money, but if you're interested in getting together online with a bunch of other actors, if you happen to be in the same city or same place, even better. You know, let's get a room above a pub or something, or a hall and a in a mosque or a church or something like that, and just come together and go, right, we're going to table read this, we're going to look down, and you can even do that with sections in your book and just go, you know, appoint characters to it. Someone does the, someone reads the kind of narration, and others read the dialogue, and you know, and you get an awful lot of value from that, because you know, if you want that kind of support network and for people to give you information about your own writing, that's a great way of doing it. Bring it alive, dramatize it. I'm a big fan of that. And you know, people have said to me, and I don't regard this as a negative at all, quite a few people have said to me that Water Street scans as a screenplay. It scans as they feel like they're watching a film or a,
and that
comes from my discipline. I'm into show, don't tell. I like to tell story through action rather than exposition dump everything. So yeah, there were other very, very successful novelists who don't do that. They get into the characters' heads and they throw it all at you, and you know, you've got to be really, really good at that to be able to get away with it.
A balance between show, don't tell, and getting in a character's head. And you know, what are you gonna, you know, when are you gonna tell? And when are you gonna show? And because that's the advantage of a novel, is you can get in a character's head and you can tell people what the character's actually thinking. So
yeah, absolutely. When you talk about, you know, something else I'm kind of getting into a little bit is like the whole immersive thing. So you know, Unreal Engine and spaces and digital spaces and how that kind of maps to the real world. But even with that, even like games and games engines and that type of storytelling, which is kind of, you have to kind of approach that in a different way. I don't think that's as immersive as a novel. I really don't. I think we're going to have to go a long way before we find anything that is kind of, because I suppose in a sense, yeah, you're the reader. You can't change what's going to happen in that book. Whereas in a game you could, but in real life, you know, you can't always change what's going to happen. And actually, if it's a good novel and if you're invested in it and you've got that kind of amazing sort of relaxation and that transportation, which people want, you know, because they want to get out of themselves really. And everyone wants that, you know, one time or another. You can go for a run and do that, or you can read a book, and if the book's good, then it will succeed in that. I'll go back to it though, even though the novel's been around for hundreds of years, it's still the pinnacle for me. It's still the top form. Right. You know, some people might say it's the feature film, and I love cinema. I absolutely do love cinema. I don't think one thing has to be more than the other, but I think, you know, the well-crafted novel is the most immersive form that's available to you. And it's something that's brought me back into it, because I started as a novelist and I wrote a short film. I was living down in London. I see myself as a kid back then. It was when I was doing all that Russian stuff and the crazy Russian stuff.
And then you became a spy.
And then I became a spy. Wasn't very good at it. Like, you know. So
John, last question. If you were to describe your book in three words, the three words that basically distill the essence of your book, Water Street, what would they be?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Johnson didn't tell you I was going to ask this question, huh?
No, he didn't. You know, this snuck up and surprised me. Three words. The American condition.
The American wow. Oh, wow. Okay, my mind is officially blown. We should get a cut right now on this podcast. Oh, wow. Thank you, John. Thank you.
I absolutely appreciate it. It's brilliant. Thank you so much. It really, really, I'm honored and privileged to speak to you, Shanas. That's really, 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 really cool. Thank you.
And that's my conversation with John Maxwell. Wow, right? Was so much fun, as always. There are a few episodes upcoming for this podcast. I know I'm behind again, So we have book club episodes and a couple more author conversations, and maybe I'll do a quarterly book review of my reading, because month in review for 2024 is going nowhere. Anyway, we'll keep you posted, and that's all I have for this episode. Before I go, if you loved this episode or any of my previous episodes, please take a moment to write me a review on Apple Podcasts. Please share this podcast with your family and friends and through your social media channels. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram on Living a Life Through Books. I'm also on Clubhouse. Look me up by name. I'm on TikTok. My tag is at Dr. Shanaz Ahmed. You can reach me through email. My address is livingalifethroughbooks@gmail.com. My website is shanazahmed.com. That is shanazahmed.com. The opening and closing music to this and all my previous episodes was composed by my husband, Brad Slavik. I'm Dr. Shanaz Ahmed with Living a Life Through Books signing off. Remember to water the seeds within you. It's time.